Species.
Unite.
We are fed things like Little Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Pigs. And, you know, we grow up on this stuff, you know, that the wolf is this big bad character. And what the real wolf is like is so totally different.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. A couple of months ago, we did a series on wolves. They focused on the massacre of entire wolf populations in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And at that time, I said I did enough wolf episodes. But the truth is, we didn't do enough, because they're still not on the endangered species list in those states. Until then, I don't think I can shut up about what we're doing to wolves, because it's absolutely horrific. So this conversation today is with Suzanne Stone. Suzanne has worked with wolves for her entire career, but since 2008, when the Wood River Wolf Project began, her career really became about solutions. The Wood River Wolf Project is a collaborative of community members, livestock producers, wildlife NGOs, and county, state, and federal agencies. And they're working together to use proactive and non-lethal deterrence to minimize conflicts between livestock and wolves. It's really nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
So I did a lot of episodes on wolves this spring, and I spent time in Idaho and Montana, Wyoming, and I saw some wolves, and then I said, okay, I'm finished. Like, I've been talking about wolves so much that I'm starting to drive people crazy, I think. But you know what? I can't stop talking about wolves. And to talk to you is like a great honor, and I'm really happy to have you on. So thank you.
Oh, no, it's my honor. Thank you for having me and still talking about wolves, because, you know, I didn't think that we would be talking about wolves in this kind of manner 30 some odd years after starting to work on them. And I never thought I would live to see bounties back on wolves, people killing pups and dens, just the horrendous, you know, way that Idaho is treating its wolf population right now. It just, I didn't think that I would ever see that again in my lifetime, that, you know, we'd go back to these barbaric 19th century eradication practices. So I'm really grateful that you're still talking about wolves.
I can't believe it either, because I talk about pretty much all animals that we are terrible to, which is pretty much all animals. But the wolf thing, I think, in particular makes me insane, because not that there's logic to what we're doing to many animals anyway, but with the wolf thing, there's zero. There's so little that they're doing to harm humans, the planet, cattle even. And the fear and the hatred are so big. And it seems almost metaphorical for so many other political issues happening in this country, which we won't get into, but it is. It's kind of like humanity at its absolute worst. And so I've been learning about you. First of all, I learned about the first time you saw a wolf. Will you talk about that?
The first time I actually saw a wolf was in Texas when I was like 17 years old, and I didn't know what I was looking at. I knew it wasn't a coyote or a big dog, and I knew it was out in the middle of nowhere, and that was incredible. It started my curiosity of wolves at that point.
You saw a red wolf, right, in Texas? And there weren't really any red wolves left when you saw this wolf.
No known ones. You know, they estimated the population had been decimated by that point, and that they knew of no ones left in the wild. But the red wolves have an exciting story in that this last few years, they've documented this red wolf canine not far from where I saw them, the one, and there's a whole, like, they found whole packs of them at this point. But it's just fascinating that they could have survived under our noses for this long. Texas, you know, is known for its big, wide open, you know, deserts and things like that. But it also has vast, like, brushland and big thicket areas. And, you know, you could hide quite a bit.
You seeing this wolf, though, this is kind of what spurred your whole life.
Right. Yeah. It was incredible. And just seeing the intelligence in his eyes, and then, and being a big dog person, because I've, you know, grew up with dogs, and I just wanted to know more. And I was frustrated that I couldn't find out anything more. You know, back then there really weren't very many books out about them, very few stories that weren't negative. And so, you know, it's really changed a lot since I was a teenager. But then my first time experience of going out howling for wolves, trying to find them here in Idaho, was also just bizarre. I mean, I went out with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wolf coordinator for the whole region. And it was my first time out with the big boss, right? You know, as an intern, he was teaching me how to do howling. And we were going up these areas in the backcountry where people had been reporting seeing wolves. And so there was a real chance of having, our first wild wolves respond. So my first time to go to howl solo, I got out one howl and thought, well, that's pretty good. And then the second howl, about midway through, we had rifle bullets whistle zing right over the top of our heads. And so one of the camps close by, just one of the hunting outfitters just picked up a rifle and shot toward the road and couldn't see us, but was, you know, thinking that he was shooting at a wolf. It was just a wild introduction to just how difficult it is for them here in the West.
Well, and how difficult it would be for you for the next 30 years in the sense of what you're up against.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I went in with eyes wide open at that point.
This was before reintroduction, right?
Before the reintroductions. Wolves had been, you know, they're part of the historic native species for Idaho, but they had been eradicated in the 1920s, 1930s. So after years of poisoning campaigns and things like that, they were gone as far as we knew.
And back then, I was thinking about this, like, because I've talked to a lot of wolf people, and a lot of them are wildlife biologists. But you couldn't really study wolves, could you, at that point? Like, we didn't have any.
We had a few in northwestern Montana that had come in from Canada. So there were a few, but I chose a different path. I was studying biology at that time, but then I also, my mentor named Jay Gore from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, he was wonderful. And he said, you know, we've got wolf biologists out there that are just tripping over each other. There's so many of them. But what we really need is somebody that understands human nature. And so please think about, you know, really diving deeply into the human nature aspects of it. And I thought, oh, that's the last thing I want to study is people. But, you know, I'm here because I love these wolves. And he's like, you know, but you could actually help. And so I went into wildlife management and then conflict resolution and really did start studying the human aspects of this whole thing. And so it's helped me a lot. I still appreciate my biology background, but that was also really good advice.
Yeah. Well, in terms of what you've accomplished as well, you kind of needed it, I think, right?
Yeah, definitely did.
Up until you started the Wood River Wolf Project, what were you doing?
Right after my internship, I started working on educational outreach and doing, so I did school programs for probably 50,000 students and adults throughout the region. And then got tagged into the team that went to Canada to capture the wolves and do the reintroduction for Yellowstone and for central Idaho. So I was actually on the ground up in Canada catching wolves and helping care for them and then helping with the release down on this end. And that was thrilling to be part of that whole effort.
And was there a ton of resistance then as well with all of this, with the reintroduction?
Yeah, it was a bit scary. We had signs up around, we went up through Salmon one of the years for when we did the release, in Salmon, Idaho, they had signs up that said, kill all the wolves and all the people who brought them here. You know, it was just, it was tense. We had law enforcement with us. And I remember I was riding in the, we had a long line of vehicles but at the front of that little convoy that was taking the wolves into the backcountry, was a really good law enforcement officer that I knew and trusted well. And he was like, you know, we're going in first. And so if anybody up ahead actually does start shooting, they're going to shoot at us first. And I remember looking back behind us and looking at all the vehicles and considering who was in them and thinking, you're the only person that has a gun to shoot back. So I'm staying with you. And it was, you know, we didn't run into the what they thought was going to potentially be an armed resistance, but it was still, you know, we knew that there were certain people that were very angry and thought that these were just monsters that we were bringing in, had no idea, you know, why we would try to restore a species like this, thought we were part of a big government plot. I mean, it was just the misinformation about it was so extreme. So it was a challenge.
Fake news was going on even way back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes.
You bring the wolves back, which is like miraculous that this even happened, right? Like so many things had to kind of work and fall into place for this to happen. And all of a sudden, landscapes start to change. Yellowstone changes a whole lot. When that started happening, was there like an awareness around it? Were people excited about it?
They were very excited about it. So there was a ton of people that, you know, went to Yellowstone. We were just overwhelmed by the amount of interest in the wolves and how many millions of dollars it was bringing into the local economy. It just, you know, it was a new season for a lot of the people in the Yellowstone region, especially because, you know, people just didn't visit the park during the wintertime. And now there's a lot of visitors during the wintertime because the wolves are very active then and easier to see. And so we, you know, now have real four seasons of tourism occurring. But, you know, beyond that, it was also that even though there were conflicts, you know, where we do occasionally had, you know, sheep lost or cows lost, it was not the end of the world scenario that many people had expected. And that was good because it gave people a chance to kind of catch their breath, learn from the wolves directly what living them with them was like. And a lot of people just realized that their fears had been overblown. And so things did calm down for quite a while. And the ranching community where they used to, you know, come out by the hundreds for meetings, we would see meetings where there were two or three, you know, that would show up. And you know, it was a lot more manageable, I think, than the conflicts were a lot more manageable than what people had anticipated. You know, there were even like Western senators who had predicted children being, you know, killed at bus stops and things like that before the release of the wolves. And of course the wolves didn't bother any people. They didn't attack anyone, certainly not kids. And, you know, so I think people were starting to get, they realize that there's a big difference between our perception of wolves, because we are fed things like Little Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Pigs. And, you know, we grow up on this stuff, you know, that the wolf is this big bad character, and what the real wolf is like is so totally different. And so it was good to see people starting to adjust to having them on the landscape again.
How long did this harmony out there last?
I'm not sure harmony would be how I'd describe it. You know, the tolerance was pretty high. I did a lot of research on just, you know, talking to ranchers and doing survey work with them and finding out, you know, what they were concerned about. And it was pretty stable up until about 10 years ago. And about that time, it was when wolves lost their protection under the Endangered Species Act. There were these new, hunting groups, that'd be a way to define them, but they were much more extreme than the older hunting groups. So whereas the older groups really talked about things of like ethics and how important it was for biodiversity and that they were part of conservation efforts and things like that, this new group seemed to be more about the guns. You know, the bigger, the badder guns, the more of them, the bigger trucks, you know, ATVs and killing, You know, it wasn't about the hunting experience anymore. It was really about, you know, how many animals were killed. And so it just really changed. The narrative within the hunting community changed a lot.
When did it get like specifically just horrific in terms of like you can shoot wolves in their dens? The rules all went away, especially Idaho, but Montana, Wyoming too.
A year ago. Yeah, a year ago. And it was through the state legislature, and they didn't ask for facts, didn't look for information outside of their own imagination and rumor, fairy tales, I mean, all of that. And it just like it fed on this hyper fear and propaganda that was being spread within the state legislature here in Idaho, and I think Montana to some degree as well. And there was just nothing there to stop or to be a counterbalance to that. So there was no information that they would even consider, you know, the scientific parts of the issues or how many actual livestock losses had occurred. I mean, the state of Idaho is now spending millions of dollars to protect what amounts to be about, you know, thousands of dollars worth of cattle and sheep, millions of dollars to kill wolves so that they can protect thousands of dollars of sheep and cattle. And it's like, it doesn't make sense economically. It certainly isn't the best method because we know that the non-lethal tools are much more effective at protecting livestock and they're more economical. So if you really wanted to protect livestock, you would do it proactively with these non-lethal measures to avoid having losses to wolves and bears and mountain lions and all the other critters that we live with. But there's just this blatant refusal that it's better to kill wolves than to do anything else to actually protect livestock.
Is the ranching community still really anti-wolf, or is it more now extreme hunters or both?
You know, I'm not sure that the ranching community has gone full swing this way, but the hunting community definitely has. I don't recognize them from the hunters from my youth that talked about things like fair chase and ethical hunting and giving back to the environment and the experience of being out in nature being the most valuable part of the reason that they hunted. You know, this is about something totally different. It's about killing. And it's just changed so much. And it concerns me for the people that are being raised in that kind of environment, the children especially, because, you know, if you don't have the counterbalance of what is fair chase and what is the animal's right to be out there as well and respect for the environment, for nature, for those animals, then you stand a really good chance of losing them. It's really different. The hunting community, has gone one way. The ranching community, I think, hasn't budged much from the leadership within the ranching community has always been pretty anti-wolf. And they definitely stimulated this last year's anti-wolf legislation. So they were at the table working with the more extreme hunting groups to get that done.
Talk about the Wood River Wolf Project, because that's with ranchers. Pretty much, right?
Right.
But how did this even start?
Making friends with people on the other side, you know, just really listening to people and trying to find out, you know, is there opportunity for meeting halfway? So when in Blaine County, we had our first pack of wolves and the locals were treating it like Yellowstone, where they'd go out with their spotting scopes and watch these wolves play at the den with their pups. And we're so excited about having a local community of wolves there. And then a sheep truck pulled up with another rancher's operation, and a few thousand sheep were unloaded in the same meadow where the wolves were raising their young. And within 48 hours, we had dead sheep, dead livestock guardian dog, and the wolves were on the chopping block. The Fish and Wildlife Service was going to use lethal to remove the pack because of the conflict.
I mean, that is so unfair, first of all, that like you put the sheep right where the wolves are.
On public land, you know, federal right. Public land. And so we're like, okay, what can we do? Let's reach out to the rancher. Let's see if he'd be willing to try these non-lethal tools. So we had a dear friend, Rick Williamson from the Wildlife Services here in Idaho. And he was a Wildlife Services investigator. And he was one that developed a conscience about killing wolves and was just suddenly really appalled by what was going on and was like, became very dedicated to trying to find and use and develop non-lethal measures so that ranchers could peacefully coexist with wolves. And I was one of his early supporters and trying to get things like the turbo flattery. He actually invented turbo flattery. Flattery had been around for generations, but he was the one that electrified it and really helped make it become a non-lethal tool, which is it's a type of fencing that works really well in certain situations. And
is that with the flags?
Yep.
So it's like fences with like colored flags.
It looks like, you know, what should be strung up around a used car parking lot. You know, it's just doesn't look like it's scary at all unless you're a wolf. And turns out that, you know, that they don't like the stuff very much at all. But it came originally from like the area near Poland and East Germany, where villagers would set up their clothing in strips on big ropes, and they would use it to try to catch or scare wolves into a certain area so hunters could kill them. And at the time, the real belief around, even in the wolf circles, from the scientists, both nationally and internationally, was that you couldn't use these methods on a wide scale. You could do it in a pasture or very small situation on a ranch, but never on this big wide scale across public lands. And that was the going thought of the day. I mean, it was in all the scientific literature and stuff. So we did a lit review, looked at that literature and just went, okay, they're all saying this won't work, but I don't see a single example where anybody's tried it. So why don't we try it? We'll get the flattery up. We'll put out those sheep in night corrals at night and see if it works.
How did you try it?
So we put the sheep in these night corrals at night, and then the agency said that they would give us time to try it. If we had another problem, then the wolves would die. And so we put them in the sheep in at night and behind this flattery line. It's the flattery enclosure, and we electrified that, and then one of the herders watched as a wolf came chasing out of the woods after a sheep, and the sheep ran into the flattery enclosure, and the wolf put his brakes on and just went, yeah, not going there, and turned around and ran the other way. And that at that point, that herder was completely convinced that this stuff works. So we had buy-in from the herders, and for the rest of the grazing season that summer, we didn't have another sheep loss at all. Even though wolves were right there, you could hear them from sheep camp. At the end of this, the community and the producers, we all got together for a meeting, and we said, look, it works, you know, and they're like, great, do it again next year. And so we set up a 3-year demonstration project, which turned into a 7-year demonstration project. And now we're going on year 15. And out of 20,000 sheep in our project area every year on rugged national forest terrain, we lose on average about just under 5 sheep a year, which is the lowest loss rate of anywhere. We have wolves and sheep overlapping because predators do like to prey on sheep, and they're one of the easiest animals in the world to prey on. But this is such a low loss rate that the ranchers are like, you know, this works better than the lethal, because even if you're taking packs of wolves out, you're still going to end up losing a lot more sheep than using these non-lethal measures proactively.
Okay, so my first question, and I'm sure this is everybody's first question, why isn't every rancher out there doing this?
It's a good question, you know, and there are a lot of ranchers who are doing it. I think that there's either a disconnect between people, their understanding of how well this works, distrust of something that they haven't done or tried before, or they simply just want to kill wolves. And it doesn't seem like there's really many other answers besides that. You know, the tools are there. There's equipment available for them. There's funding to be able to do it. And yet, you know, the buy-in is really low. So, you know, at some point, we got to realize as a nation that it's easier for these ranchers to pick up the phone and demand that the wolves be killed than it is for them to order turbo flattery or ask for help and putting, you know, deterrents out around their sheep or clean up carcass pits or all of those things. So we've made it so easy because we subsidize the killing and we rarely subsidize the actual solutions.
I mean, it should be a requirement. If you're going to have your sheep on public lands, you know, this is how you do it.
Yeah, it should be.
So I don't know if you know the answer to this, but in terms of how many ranchers there are, you know, percentage-wise? How many are doing like coexistence type work?
It's growing, and there's a National Agricultural Statistics Service that has a survey that it sends out every 5 years to the ranching community. So both the sheep producers and the cattle producers are reporting that they are investing more in the non-lethal, that they're learning more about it, that trust is growing, but it's slow.
Too slow, especially right now. You've literally changed the game for the ranchers that are using it. And you're doing work with other animals in other countries. And will you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so a lot of our methods are ones that can work with coyotes, bears, mountain lions. I was out talking about this project in different places like Australia and Europe and Africa. People were like, wait a minute, you know, we could take some parts of what you're doing and use it in our project area, and maybe it'll work with dingo, or, you know, maybe it'll work with wolves in Israel, or, you know, wherever. So we've started finding each other, and the coexistence as a movement within wildlife conservation has really been only active for the last decade or so. And so before then, you never heard that word, and it was very rare for people to focus on this part of it. So it's been great to have, you know, people not only learning from our project, but teaching us. So we've been able to add new tools to our system as well.
It's awesome. And it's funny because I think like for centuries or eons, coexistence was the only way we did things, right? And then we went the other way.
Then we forgot. Forgot about our roots. And then there's places in the world where you can go still and see like, Turkey and Israel, some of the old farming methods, certainly back in Albania and other places. I mean, they're still using livestock guardian dogs in a way that works with wolves.
Will you talk about the dogs too? And do the dogs really help?
The dogs can help. They can actually cause a problem too. So knowing how and when to use the dogs is super important. The dogs, two wolves. Dogs are funny looking wolves. And if you look at just the genetics, right, that's what they are. They're funny looking wolves, right? They share 98% of the same genetic material. And so it's like in the springtime, the biggest threat to a wolf, to their litter of pups, when they only have one litter per year, is strange wolves. And so if you introduce dogs into their area near their den site, their first reaction is to be very aggressive in defending their young, which is what happened that first year. They weren't trying to prey on the dog. They were just freaked out that the dog was going to come in and kill their pups. And that does happen with strange wolves. So we try to, you know, make sure that the herders and the ranchers understand that any other time of the year, the dogs are great because they do resemble strange looking wolves. And strange looking wolves are something that wolves tend to avoid any other time of the year. They just work their best to avoid them. And it's rare for us to see dogs being lost outside of that spring denning season. And when the pups are really little, when they go to rendezvous sites. So at one time a year, we want to make sure there's other deterrents in place that protect the dogs and that they don't go on top of the den sites where the wolves are trying to raise their young. And then the other times of the year to make sure that, that we are using the dogs, 3, 4, 5 dogs together, which resembles a wolf pack. So, yeah.
Before we go, I just want to talk about the Idaho situation a little bit because I think it's the worst, right, of anywhere.
And I think it's the worst place in the world to be a wolf right now.
And there's not even that many wolves left considering how big Idaho is.
We have somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 mountain lions in our state, 20,000, 25,000 black bear, 50,000 coyotes, over 250,000 deer, and over 100,000 elk and stuff. I mean, so we have a lot of wildlife here. And we have probably less than 1,000 wolves left. And we don't know how low that number is going. The state is using a monitoring method that is scientifically disproven to be, it's not effective at counting populations. And so we don't know, and the state doesn't know, as far as we can tell, how many wolves we have left. And like last year alone, they killed 500 wolves. And those are just the ones that we know of, not, you know, illegal kills as well. There's a bounty on wolves now, up to $2,500 per wolf. And that bounty applies to even pups in the den. So it's horrific.
And is it an all year round? It's open season kind of thing on wolves?
All year round. Yeah.
So very well, Idaho could have zero wolves at some point.
If we keep going. Yeah. If this is allowed to keep going, eventually we will have zero wolves. There's no way that this can be sustained. It's just brutal. And it's, you know, it's four times the amount of bounty that led to the wolves' initial eradication from the West. So, and we have tools now. You know, back then they used poison, but they didn't have high powered weapons. They didn't have these kinds of traps and snares that are so effective. They, you know, they've got body gripping traps now. I mean, the tools they're using are so far advanced from what they had. They're even using drones to search out for wolves. So it's night scopes, you know. So
they don't have a chance.
They don't have a chance if they keep going this way.
And there's a possibility of that they'll get back on the endangered species list sometime next year, right? Is that really a possibility?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has agreed that they deserve consideration for listing back under the Endangered Species Act. And they're supposed to come out with their decision in September. And at that point, they'll open up a comment period that allows the public to get involved and to comment on this. There will be lawsuits, I'm sure, you know, regardless of which decision and how soon they make it. But it could conceivably be several years before we see wolves back under the safety net of the Endangered Species Act.
Which means wolves could pretty much be gone by the time that happens.
I hope they're not gone.
Yeah. I hope not either.
You know, we even saw a deep impact of the Yellowstone wolves this year. Like, I think close to a third of the wolves from Yellowstone were baited out of the park by hunters and killed. It's never happened before. So it's not just Idaho that's being hyper-aggressive. It's Montana following in Idaho's footsteps. And it's also, you know, Wyoming, nearly 90% of the state, where you can shoot a wolf on sight anytime you want. You know, so it's not recovery. We were always told that the delisting of wolves in the region that was taken on by the Fish and Wildlife Service was a recovery. And at this point, that recovery is completely threatened. So if the service doesn't take action now, Deb Holland, Secretary Holland, she could tomorrow sign a emergency listing, which they promised to do as part of the delisting. I mean, they have it, you know, in writing as part of the 2009 regulatory rule that they passed, that if a state passed a laws allowing unlimited and unregulated killing of wolves, that they would immediately pursue an emergency listing. And that's been a year.
And she's not doing it. And she's kind of arms pinned behind her back and politically, you know, like, because I keep saying, like, why doesn't she just sign the damn thing? And everyone tells me, well, she can't. She can, though. I mean,
she can. You know, it's 180 days. It buys like a little time, and especially time that, you know, to get us through up to the next political season, where the states could decide to back off a little bit and just start re-embrace a responsible management. But there's no reason that I can see that wolves, that they've waited this long.
When did you start doing this? In the 80s? So how many years is that? 40 years you've been doing this?
Close to it, yeah.
This is it, right, in terms of how bad things get?
I've never thought I'd live to see this, because, I mean, it's one thing, you know, having wolves hunted and, you know, all the things we had to accept of having them back on the landscape, where they came from. They were being killed as well up in Canada, but nobody had ever tried to, like, completely eradicate the species. And I think that our state is doing that with this denial. I mean, they keep saying that despite killing 500 or more wolves a year, that the population remains unchanged. And we know that that's not true, that scientifically that's been proven time and again, that if people kill, you know, up to a third of the population or more, the population will decline. And they're reporting no declines now for that kind of aggressive killing for 5 years. So we don't know what's left of the wolf population. We know that there are some wolves left, but it does not make any sense to wait, so especially sorry. Now. Yeah.
And is there anything people aside from Deb Helen can do?
There is a comment period that's open that the Fish and Wildlife Service is still accepting public comments on their website. And, you know, if people feel compelled to write to them, if there's any information that they have, specific studies that they'd like to share, anything about human psychology, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff from, you know, they need to be looking at this from a social science perspective as well as the biological. And I think that's my biggest concern is that they're taking this, the state of Idaho's word that the population is just fine. And we know that that's not true. So the service needs to do a deeper dive and really examine, you know, what kind of methods are being used to monitor the population and how unreliable they are and how much political pressure there is right now to kill wolves in the state.
Man, I'm sorry.
Didn't expect it to be this rough at this end, but we're not giving up. Won't give up.
Good. We need you not to give up.
Beth, thanks so much for sticking with this issue because people need to know. We need to demand that our public lands actually be representative of our own values at this point in time. And as an American people, I don't think that we value having pups killed in their dens and this type of slaughter going on. We need to also demand that the ranching industry use good stewardship methods that are common sense, that will cost us less in terms of the overall funding that it goes into sustaining and supporting the livestock industry on public lands. I mean, we pay for a lot of that. And, you know, shouldn't our money be going into non-lethal, proactive, sustainable methods as opposed to just killing wildlife? That should be something that we all demand.
Absolutely.
Thank you for raising that awareness.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. To learn more about Suzanne, to learn about the Wood River Wolf Project, and to learn about the International Wildlife Coexistence Network, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything, including petitions and calls to action to how you can help stop the massacre of wolves. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you would like to support Species Unite, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Bethany Jones, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.